Shut up and sit down.
Welcome to the Health and Wealth Podcast with your hosts, Tim and Carter.
What's trending in Richards? Carter Wilcoxon, founder of CSI Financial Group here with my co-host and former wealth advisor, Tim James, founder of
ChemicalFreeBody.com and your new health advisor. This is the show where we reveal the connection between physical and financial abundance.
Hey, welcome back in Richards. Carter Wilcoxon coming to you from a nice and cool Phoenix, Arizona. It's kind of a blessing here. Today also happens to be, and I've got to give a shout out right out of the beginning. Today is my little brother's 50th birthday. And I got to tell you that I am so proud of this kid for how far he's come. It's not even funny. So, Curtis, I hope you have a phenomenal, amazing day. I know I called you first thing this morning. But anyway, I just had to throw that out there just real quick on this recording. And as is normal, I'm joined by my fantastic, amazing Mr. Chemical Free Body co-host himself, Tim James. Tim, how are you doing, my man?
Hey, man, I'm doing awesome. Excited to chat with our guest today. And I noticed on his website they have a golf tournament. So I'm sure you're going to be talking about that.
Well, you know, I mean, it's inevitable. You know, look, the financial services business are chock full of people that do a lot of business on the golf course. It just kind of comes with the
job.
I'm not saying necessarily that that's the case with our guest today, but we won't speak for him. We're going to go ahead and bring in Paul Lim from San Diego, who is a financial advisor. However, with that being said, you know, we really want to talk about his association with the San Diego Financial Literacy Center a lot today on the show, and I'm excited for him to be able to share with that. But Paul, let's go ahead and bring you in, and thanks for joining us today.
Carter, thanks for so much for inviting me on the show.
Yeah, absolutely our pleasure. So, and Richards, thank you for joining us for another episode of the Health and Wealth Podcast. And let's go ahead and just jump right on into it. As is normal, what we like to do around here, Paul, is we like to find out, how did you get to where you're at? I mean, almost without exception, no one's waking up, unless they're born into it, wanting to be a financial advisor. So let's go in the way back machine, and let's discuss a little bit about what was some of your, you know, influences along the way that brought you into having a heart for helping people in the financial services arena.
Sure. So I think it really was influenced primarily by studying economics in school. And, you know, what I really liked about that, aside from the fact that you could make money with money and manifest currency out of nothing, it was the fact that you can utilize these graphs in order to predict human behavior. And it's just kind of amazing. You know, people will say follow the money all the time, and humans respond to incentives. And when you can graph that out and have mathematical formula to that, that was just so fascinating to me, that you could predict what people are going to do with numbers and things of that nature. So economics to me was interesting, because what you can do is you can take something that is seemingly malevolent, human selfishness, and you can turn it into something beautiful, which is the efficient allocation of resources. You know, they'll talk all about these various curves and people acting rationally and having minimal arbitrage opportunities, because people will always hunt after the best deal and things of that nature. And it was so explanatory as far as human behavior was concerned. I just realized that, like, wow, you can actually predict what some people are going to do with math. And it was just a fascinating dive into it. So, you know, when you are first coming out of school, I was with American Express Financial Advisors, Ameriprise at the time, and they did very much a financial planning approach to things. We're not just doing investments, we're doing everything related to it, because everything with a dollar sign next to it bleeds into so many different areas. And that was my very first job out of school. It's all I've ever done since I've graduated. So this is kind of the only career that I know, so to speak. It also made me realize that when you're in school, they don't really teach you a lot about sales and marketing and persuasion and doing meetings and presenting and things of that nature. And I was horrible at it in the beginning, but I realized that being in this career would certainly facilitate my ability to make up for those deficiencies and address my blind spots, things of that nature. So I knew I had the technical acumen and being smart enough to understand things as they work. But what I really needed to be a more well-rounded person was all of the skills that come in to becoming a good salesperson, things of that nature.
Nice. That's a really interesting story. So you ended up, now are you born and raised in the San Diego area?
No, I was actually a East Coast person. So I grew up in Rhode Island, which is where Family Guy is from, and then went to school in Baltimore 7 years, graduated from Johns Hopkins with Bachelor in Economics, things of that nature. I know that people know them for biomedical engineering, but our econ program was number 3 at the time. So it was pretty competitive as far as that was concerned. And then moved out here in 2009, actually. So still been here for quite a while.
So you started in what year then? Or did you start with American Express Advisors, Ameriprise, when you were back east? Or did you?
Oh, yeah. Right out of school, 06.
Okay. So here you are, 06 to 09. We know what that was, right? Right?
Oh,
that
yeah.
Of the Great Recession, right?
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about maybe some of the adversity that you had to get through, as not only are you transitioning from the East Coast lifestyle to the West Coast, which is like night and day, right? Now you're also in the financial services business dealing with the Great Recession. Talk about what that challenge was like.
Yeah, you know, this is a good time for you to be asking that question, Carter, because, you know, for the first time in probably 15 years, we've got interest rates that are in the 4s and the 5s and things of that nature. And I do remember being able to utilize products that benefited quite a bit from higher interest rates, namely the annuity roll-ups, things of that nature, and crediting on various products. Because as you know, life insurance companies are in the business of hoarding cash, and therefore higher interest rates you can earn by doing nothing, utilizing the risk-free rate or CDs or instruments of that nature. It just made everything after the Great Recession look so unappealing after that point in time. You know, I know that there were a lot of people selling these 4 or 5% roll-up type products in 09 and beyond. And I was like, I'm not used to that. I used to have these things at 7. And this was, of course, before the figurative, let's use a different way to say, before the bottom fell out, let's say that way, right? And we all know what kind of what happened then. It was also very instructive as far as risk management is concerned, because most of the time stock market goes up, but then to have that happen very early on in your formative years, boy, it made me really cognizant of the importance of risk management and the fact that there are outlier periods of time during which all assets can go down together, thus defying popular consensus in textbooks and things of that nature.
Yeah, the whole like stock, bond, cash portfolio thing doesn't necessarily.
Oh, yeah, that went all out the window. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So I am curious. I want to know, because you're an East Coast kid, so to speak. And I'm saying kid because I noticed on your bio that you were a 30 under 30 San Diego leader. I know I'm paraphrasing there, but what was it like moving from the East Coast to the West Coast?
Sure. Well, it was a very long time ago that I got that, for sure. You know, I'll be at the point where I'm no longer even qualified for 40 under 40 and that kind of a thing, just to give you a clue. Not that you could have not figured it out from doing some simple math here, but really what I saw is some opportunity in chaos. So right after a Great Recession occurred, let's just say there were a lot of financial services companies that were making egregious adjustments to, let's say, their compensation structure, to the point where, because humans respond to incentives, you can start looking and getting a fresh start. So I just said to myself, you know what, this is kind of like a clean slate. I can kind of go anywhere I want to. I have nothing tying me down here. If I could start all over again, what would I do? And it just gave me the freedom to walk away and just start a whole new life, not knowing anybody, things of that nature. But you come out here, it's quite an experience. And if you have no friends or connections out here, it does kind of force you to put yourself out in the community, become somewhat involved as far as various activities and networking opportunities are concerned, things of that nature. But the culture shift was very remarkable because on the East Coast, I would say the predominant work culture is, I work harder than you do. Look at how busy I am. And that's their status symbol. Whereas on the West Coast, it's more like, look at how much free time I have. Look at all the things that I can do. This is my status symbol. It was very nice. And so being able to come to that with the East Coast work ethic, things of that nature, to place in which you wouldn't need necessarily conform to that same rigor was quite refreshing.
Wow. So I'm curious, because you just got through saying, and I'm blown away by this, and I love it. You're obviously, you're very entrepreneurial in spirit to be like, I'm taking this risk. Now's the perfect time. You chose San Diego in Southern California, I'm assuming for a reason, but you're telling me it's not because you knew somebody there. That was just like you put your finger on a map and you're like, I guess this is where I'm going.
Look, I mean, I had some contacts and visits and things of that nature, and I'd been out here before. It's an exaggeration to say I had no friends or no contacts, but definitely not as many as I had necessarily where I grew up and where I went to school and all the contacts that I'd had there. So maybe not starting from zero. I think that was just really more illustrative of painting a picture and a way to kind of convey the events more like a story. And things like that. There was a definite reason why I wanted to come out here. It was really just hearing stories from some of my college friends who came out to the East Coast to go to school. And they were like, oh, I can't believe what it is where I am. Do you know what it's like where I live? And it's just hearing a lot of these stories and just understanding that. And, you know, there are a ton of good reasons to be out here on the West Coast, despite all of our problems and things of that nature. So it's just a choice that you make. And when you're designing your life, if you are an entrepreneur, you've got the ability to carve your own path, but it does come with tremendous responsibility. You know, I've never had a salary before. You know, everything has always been 100% commission, 100% earnings. I mean, a draw really is kind of a commission. It's really an advance against commission. So I didn't think it changed a lot of the incentives and the way in which that I approach work, because I've never been paid a dollar that I didn't bring to my company first, so to speak. And it makes it so that you never waste time when you are working, because there's no such thing as just banking hours and waiting for a certain time to arrive so you can leave. It's like, if you're not doing something there, it's like, what are you even doing at the office? And so being in that position for the entirety of the career, I think it really changed the way that I look at efficacy, things that work, systems that make sense, and items of that nature. Because the problem, if you have a salaried type job, yes, of course you have the stability, but you lose a lot of the freedom. And sometimes your economic incentives are not to say, how can I do the most amount of deals? How can I do the most amount of value to people? How can I put myself out there and market and improve and sharpen the saw, figuratively speaking? It becomes, how can I extract as much value from my employer as possible while minimizing my effort and outlay? And that can happen sometimes to some people. But if you are never in a position to where that's an option, well, it kind of changes your personality.
Yeah, well, you know, I love the whole eat what you kill mentality. And, you know, I've said for a long time, if more of the structure in the United States was performance-based as yes. opposed to, right? But at the same time, it's a balancing act. I was just having this conversation with one of my clients, and I was in Nashville just over the weekend, and I was talking about how, like, every business needs, you know, the trash collector, or the, the restaurateur needs the dishwashers, and you still need, like, everybody can't be an entrepreneur. But I don't think it's like instinctive, like, I don't think everybody can be an entrepreneur. And that was why, Tim, you know, I was excited about having Paul on the show today, because, you know, as a couple of people that started their own business and they went out there and they did it on their own, and, you know, they make it work, but, you know, you still need people around you that can help you to be successful. You know, Paul's understanding of what that takes. That's why I was excited about having him on the show today. You know, you said that so eloquently and you described it so precisely. I almost feel like you were waiting to tell me what you just got through saying about, you know, that freedom and balance that you talk about and the stability as being an employee.
Yeah, Carr, it's really funny that you bring up that incentive type structure. I really have sort of this mentality where my little cousin is now a psychologist and she's licensed. And she was telling me about how there are these certain personality archetypes and things of that nature. And she's just describing them to me. And she was like, oh, the reformer. This is the person who wants to like change the system and make things right. And I was like, oh, that is totally the thing that resonates with me the most, because sometimes, you know, you'll have these fantasies about being benevolent dictator. And it's like, oh, if someone would just let me have 100% power, I would change things and make things. And so one of the things I was, you know, kind of thinking about in my mind was like, how can we change the compensation structure of America such that it's not an hourly wage, but rather you'd have something where it's a little more entrepreneurial in nature. You don't necessarily have them take on the responsibility of creating an infrastructure or figuring things out or having to hunt and market, which is extremely difficult for people who've never done it before. But what if you had something where the fast food worker gets paid based on the number of happy meals they generate underneath their code or something of that nature, so that they are looking more forward to a time when the restaurant is busy, not during a time when they can just get paid their hourly wage and it's actually less labor if fewer people come through the door. I think the closest thing we have to that is probably tipping with waiters and waitresses and things like that. But see, those incentives are aligned because now the waiter waitress is compelled to try and do a very good job, not simply run down the clock wishing it was 4:55 so they could leave. What if there was a way for some of these admin type jobs to assign like a dollar value to all the tasks? Whatever spreadsheet, whatever amounts you complete, there's this little dollar value. You get paid nothing per hour, but it's just output and you just have them that way. Uber, I think, is very efficient and the incentives are very good in that way too. I just really like those businesses where the person knows that the more output and value they create, the more money they make at the same time. I just think there would be such a productivity boon for America if we would allow compensation structures like that, as opposed to, oh, what are we debating now? A minimum wage and this, it's just wrong. The design is going to create externalities that you don't want. And it just shocks me. I shake my head about it all the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I see that we're coming up against the clock, but I just have to say that I couldn't agree with you more, right? Like the incentive-based model is going to get you a lot more quality and quantity, right? Than the way we've basically been doing it, you know, for eons, if you will. But, you know, everything you said about that, we could have a whole nother show about some of those particular things. And I know we're going to get into more about the San Diego financial literacy after this break that we're getting ready to have. And I want to talk about that for sure. Tim, pretty cool stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And very well put. So right now we'll take a quick break. When we get back, we'll get into more of what Paul's doing in his neck of the woods when we return. We'll be right back.
Estate planning. What does that even mean? When the inevitable happens for everyone on this planet, your estate plan kicks into action. But first, let's start with what an estate is. An estate is simply everything you own. Now, here's the issue and what needs to be understood when this event occurs. You only have two choices on this plan. Number one, either you plan how your estate gets handed out and distributed to those you leave behind. Or number two, your state decides who gets everything you own. For the first time ever, you can now take complete and total control of this plan that you've been deprived of for most of your life and generations before you. You can get personalized assistance along the way with a team of specialists whose job it is to make sure you have true peace of mind. It's important to understand that estate planning is a journey, and rest assured that our team will be available to you all along the way and at every step. Welcome to Estate Plan, home of the last estate plan you'll ever need. To learn more, make sure to reach out to your local advisor licensed with us or go to our website for more information.
What's up, Enrichers? Tim James here. I'm back with my co-host, Carter Wilcoxon. So, Brad, great first episode or great first section, segment. And you know, what we wanted to do next was like, we wanted to get more into this nonprofit that you're a part of. So why don't you tell us a little about that, how you got involved in it, and what you got going on over there?
Sure. You know, in our last segment, we were talking about how, you know, incentives can drive certain things. And I had a nice mentor once tell me that if you wish to make a certain transaction occur, one of the best ways to do it is to make the client see things the way that you see things, and then the product sells itself. Because as soon as they embrace the same philosophy and the same way that you're seeing things, you don't even have to talk about any of the features or anything of that nature, because the strategy itself will compel them to want to implement the recommendation, so to speak. And so what I came to realize is that teaching is really the very best way to make someone feel confident that what they're going to be doing with you is, in fact, the most efficient route. And the approach to it is sort of the Richard Feynman thing. And I'm paraphrasing here, so forgive me. But he basically says, you learn something to the point where you can explain it to a five-year-old, and then you dig more into the detail and you refine as you go along. Anyway, I totally butchered it, but he's basically trying to say that if you cannot articulate something complicated in a way such that a young person or maybe someone with English as a second language or something like that, if you can't explain it to that type of person, if you can't simplify, if you can't zoom out and at least articulate the bigger picture, you kind of don't understand it well enough. And so one of the things that we have a tendency to do when we become familiar with nuance and technical details is to demonstrate credibility by trying to give them those kinds of details. And that's not right. In a way, it's almost disrespectful to the listener, because you should appreciate the fact that whomever you're speaking with has their own specific expertise of which you're not aware at all. And if they were to bring you into their world and start talking about technical nuance that doesn't matter and that you're not going to remember later, it's like you're not taking me on a memorable journey. You're not giving me any piece of information that has utility, nothing that's useful out of this thing. If you guys ever did art or anything in school, you do not paint a picture by starting in the corner and finishing it and going like this and then working your way through the rest of the painting that way. You do a rough sketch on the whole thing. You get maybe 20% of it down and you slowly add detail over time. And that right corner isn't finished until the whole thing is finished. So that is the way that artists sketch things out. They'll start by drawing the horizon and then getting the perspective right. And, you know, if you want to draw Bart Simpson, for example, you start with a cylinder and then you work this way and then you add this and then you add the spheres for the eyeballs and things of that nature. You do not start by completing the spiky hair and then coming down. That's not the way to do things, right? And that's not the way you explain a new concept or anything of that nature. You start big picture with a rough sketch and you slowly add detail as it's introduced in the conversation, as it's required, and things of that nature. You do not start out with granular detail and then move on. That's not how people learn. And then another concept that you can pull from many of the self-help people, I think this is Tony Robbins. He basically says the way to explain something new to someone is you attach the known to an unknown. So you take something and you will attach it to something that they already know, and then you kind of explain it in that way. So part of that and having that focus all throughout the career may be very good at taking something complicated and making it very easy to understand, no matter what it is, because I paint in broad strokes, to use my metaphor, right? And then it just made me realize that this is a differentiator with advisors, and people will feel refreshed and they go, oh, you explain things very well. And then it made me realize that that's not how a lot of educators go about doing things. A lot of coursework is mastering this detail before you see the big thing. And I was like, oh, there's got to be a better way to teach. And then, of course, it drew me to San Diego Financial Literacy Center, because I was like, yeah, why don't people know basics about income taxation? It's a meme where the taxes are so confusing that you don't even know how to do them. And yet it's something that we are all subject to. And it really bothered me that people didn't have baseline knowledge of this. And I was like, we got to do something about this. So that's what drew me into the San Diego Financial Literacy Center, to answer your question in a long-winded way.
Yeah, no, that is, I'm fascinated by all the things you're talking about. And it's interesting because my daughter, who is a total, like, you know, introvert, and I'm saying that as compared to my son, who's a total extrovert, right? But she was an artist, right? She was artistic, and I don't have that art brain whatsoever. But, you know, when you started giving that analogy, I thought, man, that's absolutely brilliant. So I'm just wondering, is that some of the, like, early, as a financial advisor, as you're talking maybe to a new prospect, and, you know, sometimes I know that we've talked to many advisors where we hear the horror story, so to speak, where they're like, just tell me what everything you know, as if there's some way you can tell them everything you know in one 15-minute conversation, right? Like there's any possible way. But I'm just wondering, is that sometimes how, when you start working with a new client, that's sort of how you, to use your analogy, paint the picture, so to speak, on how this is going to be a journey and things like that? Or is that just in your mind, just the concept as you're trying to start divulging information to them along the way?
I mean, it's both. I think that I'm sharing with you a little bit about my approach and my method as far as the way that I would explain things, especially to someone that I've never met before. And but when I'm meeting someone I've never met before, I usually let them express their thoughts. And then as they're sharing things, I'll formulate what I believe are maybe the two or three concepts that I think they should know prior to me sharing any recommendations and things of that nature. And just given where I live, it almost always starts with income tax. And
sure,
because it's also so poorly understood, and we have a culture which encourages people to get large refunds and dance around in tax software commercials, I just said, no, this is not the correct way to go. And I can't rely on mainstream publications and popular media and the corporate press to make people understand that. It's not going to happen. And so you have to give them a model and a framework for understanding things, so that when they come back, you can continue to expand on that framework and on that model. And you shouldn't give them too much detail immediately, because people don't remember everything until they hear it maybe two or three times. And that's the way that I am when I'm meeting someone who is trying to tell me about something of which I'm not aware, whether it's this part in my car or planning a banquet and learning what the difference is between a 60-inch round table and this kind of a table. And this is the way that flowers should be arranged. And it's like when I'm going into a new environment and someone's trying to do that to me, I just kind of like internalize how I'm feeling and where they're doing a good job and where they're not. And I use that as kind of corrective feedback, where I'll just tell myself, okay, that this person did not explain this well. Why didn't they explain it well? Why am I not feeling moved in order to do business with them and things of that nature? So I think people do it without really realizing it. But I wanted to know, what's the recipe? What's the secret sauce? You know, what is it that gets people to understand something? And you got to kind of pretend like every word that you'll utilize, it costs you 10 cents. So you're trying to make it as inexpensive as possible. What's the fewest number of words that I can use in order to get this idea across with maximum comprehension probability? And I'll tell you what it is if you want to know. It's visual.
Okay.
Visual is the best persuasion. So there are some people who say, oh, I'm a visual learner. Everyone's a visual learner, bud. We always do that. And so if you can use illustrative language, that is one of the most effective ways in order to get a point across. So I call it visual anchors, right? Things that you can do to explain to people. So if I'm trying to explain like tax brackets, for example, you imagine that your income is a pile of $1 bills and different parts of the color, different parts of the pile are like rainbow kind of colors and different parts of the pile are taxed at rates. And I have a visual aid that kind of explains that through. But you explain that a tax deduction is like you taking money off of the top of the pile and doing something with it before the IRS counts it. What I just explained to you is that tax deductions happen at your marginal rate because that's the highest part of the pile. And therefore, that's going to be the highest percentage tax because, you know, the bottom dollars are taxed at the lowest and things of that nature. So by giving you that visual where I tell someone they're peeling dollars off of the top of the pile, I just conveyed something that they now understand without even realizing it. You get marginal tax deductions. That's really what the technical answer for that is. But I just made them understand something without them even realizing it just by giving them a visual.
That is seriously so awesome. Hey, Enrichers, we are joined today by Paul Lim. So obviously, you know, San Diego Financial Literacy Center, you know, when I think about that, I think about the failure that the public school system has done for financial literacy. So I'm curious, what type of individuals or companies or whatever are you helping in that capacity? I mean, are you talking to a lot of younger people? Are you talking to older people? How does that work?
Yeah. So, you know, we were implementing a grant from the Financial Planning Association and some other great organizations that have that as their mission. And it took the form of these bi-monthly financial opportunity clinics where people would come with all their documents on a Saturday morning. I'd get a bunch of financial advisor volunteers to give them pro bono advice and help them realize that there are some easy things they can do in order to improve their situation. And a lot of them may feel intimidated because they don't meet minimum investable assets, or they feel as though financial advisors are something that are reserved only for the wealthy or things of that nature. And so it was really meant to elevate the perception of the profession, give people free advice, and then make it so that I have the public be given some of the information that they so badly need. Because if we go back to our discussion about how people respond to incentives, there is an incentive to keep things complicated. What are all the tax lawyers going to do if we had a flat tax in this country? Yep. What are they all going to do if the laws between all the different states were fairly uniform or something of that nature? There is an incentive to create complexity, because then you can have these people serve as informational gatekeepers and monetize access to that. And I didn't like that at all. And so I was like, you know what, let's do the exact opposite of that. Let's just give people free advice and then just give it to them and then make it just that way. And just really rebel against the current system, which hides and obfuscates a lot of the basic things that are just not taught in school.
Oh, we're talking about like Rage Against the Machine over here, right? Talk about reformer, how that really resonated with you when you mentioned that. You were talking about that a little bit earlier in the show. Look, Tim and I are a couple of rebels ourselves, with a cause, not without a cause, right? And I love, seriously, Paul, everything you're doing in your community. I think it is going to serve those in such a tremendous capacity. And the compound effect of that is what we need more of. I really believe we need more of that. And hopefully you're influencing, you know, others with you, you know, being so young. You've got a lot of years ahead of you to be able to, you know, get that compound interest in, you know, that financial literacy that you are promoting. I appreciate it so much on everything that you're doing. So are you looking to, you know, expand on teaching others and bringing in more of the same mindset within the board there?
I very much am, but I got to tell you, this is all volunteer work. So I got to do this like at night after you're done doing the regular stuff and things like that. But, you know, if I could do a quick commercial for you, I am trying to create a series of videos that will be able to give people this ability. And prior to this year, some of the tools and the technology were just not quite up to snuff and not able to do what we wanted to do. But now, because I have the ability to create these videos without necessarily needing an engineer to kind of put all these things together, it's finally at the point where I feel as though the vision for what I wanted to have ideally is actually feasible and possible. You know, before we got on, we were talking a little bit about AI and things of that nature. And some of these AI tools I have utilized with great success, shocking success in terms of getting what would normally take dozens of hours just created with a couple keystrokes. It's really shocking the way that we can utilize some of this in the future to leverage our efforts so much. And so I want to say that this has gotten to the point where the technology is finally around where I can do this without having it be the full-time career. And I just said to myself, you know, you have these scripts, you do the same presentation over and over and over again. And of course, these have been refined and A/B tested through numerous iterations and meetings over many, many years. And so I think I've got it down to a point where it is lean and compelling and correct. And I was like, why don't you just record it? You know, we talk about residual income and about how that's very important because you don't want to be stuck in a situation where you're trading hours for dollars, where you're sacrificing time for money because it's not scalable. You can't make double the money by working double the hours. That doesn't make sense, right? And so the residual income, which is the way you explain stocks, you basically explain that owning a stock is being able to reap the rewards of a company without having to run the company, right? And so we extrapolate that concept and say to ourselves, why don't I just do residual teaching? And that can take the form of a video. So I don't have to be there on a Zoom meeting explaining this. Someone can watch it at 10 o'clock at night and I'm doing something else, kind of a thing. And I was like, I've got to have residual education in a certain way, right? Why am I going to say the same thing over and over again when it can just be pre-recorded and then scaled up, things of that nature? So I've been saying this probably on like several other podcasts I've been on and things of that nature. Just give me a little time to get this going. But I really am in the process of trying to make this happen. And that's where my vision is, you know, as of this recording, let's say.
Well, what you're talking about is just basically called an evergreen presentation. So you do it once and it could be a webinar. You could market it as a live webinar and then it's the same thing that goes out, but you've refined it. The whole process you talk about is what people do. They start marketing, and if people show up, they do a presentation, they record it, and then they do a live call once a week, and they sell a course as an example. And then that live call is Q&A. And after a bunch of Q&As, you see what questions didn't get answered in the presentation. You go back and redo parts of it, answer those questions. You keep refining it until the presentation's dialed, it answers all the questions. And then you now have an evergreen webinar to educate people, and it does the job without you being there, and then it leverages your time, and then you can create another one, educate them on another topic. So totally get that, like what you're doing. I think a lot of the way, for twice I've already thought about like Truth Freedom at truthfreedomhealth.com. Like I think Paul would be a great leader over there at Truth Freedom Health, which is a bottoms up working class movement. But anyway, Paul, you have to check that out. But we're going to take a quick break. And we get back, we're going to let Paul flip the script on me and ask me some questions. I think I'm pretty excited for what he's going to ask me. We'll be right back.
want the absolute best for yourself, and you want it to be easy. That's why we created Green 85. It helps with detoxifying the body gently. We're proud it's chemical-free, unlike almost all other supplements you'll find. Bottom line, Green 85 will get you healthier. We look forward to hearing what Green 85 did for you.
To get this product and our other amazing products, go to chemicalfreebody.com. That's chemicalfreebody.com.
What's up, Enrichers? Tim James here. I'm back with my co-host, Carter Wilcoxon. All right, this is the section, Paul, where we flip the script and let you ask me any question on health, whether it's your health, friends' health, family health, or public health. What you got?
Yes. So I think that if we observe the way in which the powers that be are wishing to influence us, it tends to be more towards plant-based and not having animals and things of that nature. They want us to start eating bugs. And I saw a story the other day about a student who just made some food out of plastic. And I look at some of that and I started kind of going to the other extreme. I've just always been interested in the extremely contrarian viewpoints, because sometimes you'll go down certain rabbit holes, you'll watch some person's video that asserts a seemingly ridiculous idea and you go, this will be good for a laugh. And then you start going down and hearing a little bit more about it and you go, wow, this is actually extremely compelling. So anyway, mainstream, popular culture, corporate press wants you to believe that plant-based is the way to go. It will also save the planet. But then there are these other doctors out there who have been doing carnivore diet, Dr. Paul Saladino, Dr. Sean Baker, to name a few, and things of that nature. I've even heard some people, such as Jordan Peterson, for example, say that they were able to totally heal all of their autoimmune disorders by eating beef, water, and salt. What is your opinion about the carnivore versus plant-based paradigm?
Awesome, dude. That's a great question, and I hope that I can clear that up for you today. I'm very excited to share. So the first thing that we have to understand that is everybody is different, okay? There should not be one size fits all medicine, and same thing with food, right? And then what your body needs today, it might change in 10 years or 30 years, what you might need, right? As far as nutrients and stuff like that. We are also today, we're in the modern world, we're exposed to a lot of different stuff, okay? Somebody that lives on a skyscraper that's surrounded by 5G, it's getting blasted 24/7 versus somebody like me that's out on the farm that's not getting that. That's a completely different thing. There might be somebody might be getting horrible water out of the tap water, which pretty much all the water is polluted today. It just means what level. You could be living next to a chemical factory. I may not, right? So 5G, smart meters, microwaves, stress. You might have a crappy people living in your house. They might be very negative. There's so many different factors. So when it comes down to this, I've looked at this because when I grew up on the standard American diet, and I hunted and fished, had a lot of meat, and I had deer and elk and all that stuff, and everything was fine when I was young. But by 37, my body was falling apart. I gained a bunch of weight, and I was shitting blood, and I had to be life flighted for an emergency surgery. So I went to Hippocrates Wellness Center. They are strictly highly, not just plant-based, but living food. So a lot of sprouts and sprouted nuts, sprouted seeds, sprouted grains, sprouted beans, wheatgrass shots, detoxification, this type of a stuff. Therapies. And my health completely spun around. I healed. My buddy healed himself of cancer. I had chronic lymphocytic leukemia, which is supposedly an incurable cancer. And so I had that thing. And from that experience, because I was such a mess, I became the food Nazi and I became a hardcore plant-based dude. And then about 8.5 years into it, I started about 5.5 years into it, I started loosening up a little bit because I was actually driving friends away from my life because they didn't want to be around me anymore because I was on them so much because I had such profound results. And I saw my friend heal himself of cancer. I'm like, this is the way it has to be. And it's like, you need to do this. What are you doing? Are you crazy? And so I loosened up. And then finally, about 8.5 years into it, I'm like, I saw some tooth samples type. this doctor, not doctor, but in a university, he had all these tooth samples shipped to him from all over the world because he had this new microscope. And he was able to go in and look at the tooth samples. This was in a university, all the way back through history. And what they saw was that most of these people actually were eating mostly plants, but the word there is mostly, okay, mostly. And then you could actually see that there was more pitting in their teeth during times of drought, which would mean they were eating more nuts and seeds. And they lined them up with the other, you know, geographic stuff like the dirt or whatever they were studying. And the tooth samples matched exactly with droughts in the pitting, eating more dried nuts and seeds. So I'm like, okay, well, that tells me that. And I'm like, you know what? If I was out there and I'm trying to live, like, I'm going to probably, you know, I don't have claws, I don't have teeth, and I can't run really fast compared to these other animals. I can't see as far or hear as good. I'm probably just, and I hunt and fish. Like, it'd be hard to kill stuff unless you got a gun or a knife, you know, a spear or a bow and arrow, and I've hunted with all that stuff. And so I'd probably be eating mostly, like, I'd probably eat roots and berries and stuff like that and ancestors of cabbage and spinach. And then, but when I got my hand on some meat, I'd eat it. You know, I would. So I think there was a balance of that. And then, you know, moving forward, looking at the blue zones today, there's four common factors of all the people around the world that live to 100. And the number one thing was lifelong friends. So it's actually tribal and community is number one for longevity. Number two is they had respecting their elders. Again, back to community and longevity, not social distancing. Number three was 80% plant-based diet or greater. So then I saw that again. And then four was moving the body every day, exercising. All right. So I've already coached 600 people through this process now. And when some people like Jordan Peterson is an example, I think is what happened to him is maybe he had some genetic disposition to something. His daughter was is the one who figured this thing out. It wasn't just him. He copied his daughter and he had severe autoimmune issues. Okay. So what I've seen in my work is I've seen that can work for some people. I had another guy who had cancer as a pastor up in Vancouver, Washington, and we put him on this living food diet. I'm talking lots of sprouts, sprouted nuts, seeds, grains, beans again. And he wasn't perfect, but after a year and a half, he healed himself of cancer. And what was interesting is 20 of his food allergies disappeared. And so what we've noticed is that when the immune system is dropped from being stressed, from chemical pollution in the body buildup in the fat tissue and the muscle tissue and the cells, the brain tissue, it's fat tissue, and you're deficient in nutrients, the immune system drops and you can start becoming allergic to not only foods, but pets and seasonal allergies, things outdoors. And what I've seen is as people get the stress down, as they get the chemicals out of their body and they boost the immune system up with nutrients, they heal and those things don't bother them anymore. So in the case of Jordan Peterson, I don't know if that's his situation or he just has like maybe meat works for him. But if I was to coach him and say, I know you don't want to change, but if he's like, yeah, I'm interested in exploring, I would start working on detoxification with him and working on his stress and doing everything I could with that. And then if I was to introduce plants, it would be living foods because living foods are a different beast. Like I could be a plant-based eater or vegan, and I could go down to McDonald's and eat crap down there, and I could say I'm vegan. And I'm probably going to get sick and have a poor life because the quality of the food down there is complete shit, right? But if I was to go eat a fresh pick, some kale out of my garden that's grown in mineral-rich soil, and that didn't affect me as much, or if I had sprouts, I call this the phytochemical override. So living foods have hormones, oxygen, phytochemicals, plant nutrients, same thing, and enzymes. These are all in living foods. But when you pick a food, they start going down rapidly. And when you cook a food, they're gone. You wipe them out. So this isn't just the vitamins, the minerals, and the trace minerals. I'm talking about a whole other level of nutrients that we're supposed to get that we don't get from living nutrition. Every creature on this planet eats a 100% raw living food diet, except for maybe buzzards and, you know, a few flies and stuff like that. So everybody has their place. And so we would pick food and eat it right on the spot. We didn't have refrigerators. We were walking around. We were nomadic. And we developed techniques after time, like, you know, Native Americans would take meat and pound and herbs and stuff into it and roots, and then they would dry it. And then they got nutrients like that from the meat, but mostly a lot of nutrients from the plants they beat into the meat. So that was how they got through the winter. And so what I found is that everybody's different. And so what I do when I coach people is I try to get them to first reduce stress. We're talking about diet here, but this all revolves to your diet and what you can eat. We get their stress down, get the toxins out, and then we start going with the freshest food possible. That's what I want. So if you're eating all meat, when we want you to stop eating, you know, something that's crappy, you know, hormones and antibiotics and nitrates and nitrites, and get completely grass-fed food. You know, no hormones, no nitrates, any of that crap. And then maybe we'll get to a point we would test if you're highly allergic to stuff, we would get one plant and try that in its living food form and let those plant medicine go on you and see if it works. Great. But if not, the beginning is the detoxification. So most people aren't like Jordan Peterson and his daughter. Most people don't have severe allergies like this, but a big camp does. So what I've always recommended is reduce stress, detox the body first, really get serious on your detoxification. Stop putting the toxins in, get your air cleaned up, your water cleaned up, stop wearing synthetic clothing that's off-gassing hormone mimicking chemicals into your body 24/7. Get rid of the toxic shampoos and toothpaste and eyeliner and all the stuff, that makeup and things that we're doing and all this stuff. And then eat fresh food. And what I've noticed, Paul, is that people start getting better. And then they can start eating more and more plant-based food. And they usually end up with less meat. But that's what I've noticed, okay? But then eventually what I'll do in a coaching, I'll have them go completely plant-based for 30 days and then see how they feel, and then add meat back in slowly and just see how they feel. And everybody's different. So maybe somebody needs to be 50% meat, 50% plants. Somebody might be 80%, 20%, or 100% plants. Everybody's got to find out what works for them. Now, in regards to the political comment, just because I have to figure this out, these politicians are being run by system scientists. And the system scientists know how to piss everybody off and divide people so they can conquer us. So they'll have somebody on the left say something like, we need to all eat plants, and we have to stop eating hamburgers, and we have to eat bugs and this other stuff. And there's going to be people that are going to be like, what? These people are nuts. And they start associating the craziness with the plant-based part. You see what I'm saying? And so is the plant-based thing bad? In my experience, it hasn't been. But it could be if those plants were sprayed with chemicals, right? And they were grown in nutrient deficient soils and were using genetically modified seeds. Yeah, then it would probably not be a good idea, right? Because you're still poisoning yourself. So it depends on the quality of the food. And you have to understand, these politicians will put good stuff into messages with bad stuff to confuse you and get you attached to think that it's all bad. Okay.
Great. I think I am in agreement with you about the it depends answer, because not everyone's the same. What do you think about blood type and compatibility with various diets? I've heard some people assert that the type O blood is very well geared towards meat, and then there's A and B, and then the A and B hybrid is you can do a mix of both plant meat very well. What's your opinion on blood types and diet?
Yeah. Well, the blood type diet was originally put together by a guy named Dr. Diadamo, I believe. And I remember learning about this, and where I learned from this plant-based community. Sorry, my thing, I don't have to come back to me. But he said that, you know, he had his good intentions, but he was completely wrong. And they said the reason why he is wrong is because we have had over 600,000 people to our institute, and we put them all on the same diet. And then we're talking about this. I'm talking about living foods, not just raw, but living foods. Everything's alive. And again, this probably goes back to that phytochemical override. So that's what I've seen there. But the thing of it is like, how many people are willing to go 100% living foods? Dude, it's very few. Like, even all the stuff I know, I'm not 100%. I was probably, at my peak, probably 80% living foods and growing it all myself. And because I've moved, once I move and get my new place built, then I'll probably go up to that level again because I felt best at that. But I know people that are living fooders. And we can talk about that briefly. It's called biophotons. Photons rain down from the sun. They're captured on a leaf of a plant via photosynthesis. And that's where all the nutrition is made, in the leaf of a plant. That's where it starts. And then the animal eats the plant. And we either eat the plant or the animal. These biophotons are very interesting. You can actually measure your biophoton activity. So somebody that eats 100% junk food diet will emit 1,000 biophotons off their body. Somebody who eats 100% organic, naturally occurring organic diet, but it's 100% cooked, will emit 23,000 biophotons. A newborn baby emits 43,000 biophotons. Somebody that an adult that eats 100% living foods, like all sprouts and sprouted nuts, sprouted seeds, sprouted grains, they're going to emit over 80,000 biophotons. So if you're emitting this much energy, you're going to have a lot of protection against disease, and you're going to live a lot longer. That's the bottom line. You're not going to age like everybody else. But again, how many people are going to do this, right? So I guess to answer your question about the blood type diet is that what I've noticed, besides what I just said about going 100% living fooder, then again, it would go back to it depends. And I think you have to find out what works best for you and go up and down that ladder and see what works best for you. But otherwise, I have seen most people, many people, do very well with living foods. But then again, I still think the word the depends word needs to be in there involved in that too, because, you know, I don't know if that institute had done consistent follow-up a year or two, 5 years later and see if it was still working or not.
Got it. What do you think about drinking distilled water? Because you hear some people say, well, it's going to leach minerals from your body. And then some people say, well, it only does the negatively charged ones that you don't want out of here. You look anecdotally and actually a lot of the bodybuilder types will swear about distilled water. And I'm really more focused on results when it comes to a lot of these kinds of things. And I think about that. What's your opinion on drinking distilled water?
Well, distilled water is one form of purification. There's three that I know of. You have distillation, reverse osmosis, and deionization. Those are the three purifications. So originally, I lived on a well out in the country, and my water just seemed fine. I didn't really think much about it, right? And then, there's stuff in there. Okay, we have to really, if you're living in the country, you have nitrites most likely from your septics and stuff, and it's a major problem, and it's a health cause. It should be a major concern, but nobody's talking about that. So with that, we moved to the city, and all of a sudden I could smell chlorine in the water. My wife's scalp started flaking and she was going crazy. And she bought this little $20 oil and this $30 oil and this $50 thing and the $60 cream. All of a sudden there was a $70 deal. I'm like, holy crap, this is starting to add up. Maybe I should get some type of a filter. And I bought a whole house charcoal filter, this great big, huge thing that went through. And because it was talked about getting rid of chlorine and chloramides and chloramines and all this stuff. And I knew I had chloride because I could smell it, chlorine. And we put that in there, and all of a sudden the water, man, I can't believe I was even drinking that water, because after I cleaned it, I was like, I'm like, this is so much better. I'm like, oh, what was I doing? Like bathing in this and showering in it. Like, no wonder. And her hair cleared up. It worked. I'm like, wow, it worked. And then I learned about distilled water. And so somebody convinced me to do distilled water, and I did it. And I had a distiller in my home. And they're kind of a pain in the ass to clean, by the way, and you have to clean them quite often. But the water, then I drank that water, and I didn't want to drink the purified tap water. It was like, now this is the new standard. And I'm like, this is amazing. But then I called that doctor that got me on it. I said, hey, man, I just realized, I'm like, where the hell are these chemicals going that we're filtering out? And by the way, the purification systems only pull out 90% of the contaminants. That's why you need triple purification, which that's where I'm going next. So he's like, well, they go out that little vapor valve. I was like, into the air, back into my house? I'm like, well, I don't want to breathe that shit in. So I'm like, I'm done with this. And so some people would put their distillation units under the house or somewhere or next to a purification unit to suck the air up and clean the air. So you could do that, but I didn't know about that then. So I did that. And then I went to triple purifier. My triple purifier had a specialized reverse osmosis screen, a couple pre-filters, specialized reverse osmosis, then deionization, and then like 14 other stages into this restructuring and all this cool stuff. Wow, that water is even better than the other one. Okay. And so I stuck with that for years until I found out about molecular hydrogen. And like, holy crap. And I drank some of it and I felt like lit up. I'm like, I have got to drink this water. It's amazing. So I started drinking that water. It was great. But then when I got my triple purifier installed again, I just couldn't figure this out. And now I know why. The unit that I was using to make the molecular hydrogen was a Kangen unit. And I freaking loved how it made me feel. But the problem was it's a very crude filtration system. The Kangen unit actually needs impurities in the water to make, this is what I learned, to make the molecular hydrogen, which your body's mostly made of. You're 62% by volume molecular hydrogen, 24% oxygen, 12% carbon, and 2% everything else, minerals. Okay. And so it's a major macronutrient of the human body. That's why it's freaking working so well. But when I triple purified that water, I got the water so clean that it wasn't able to make very much at all of the molecular hydrogen. I wasn't getting the benefits of the Kangen unit. The Kangen unit, from what I was told by George Wiseman, who studied these, he told me that he's like, I have one of the, because I said, dude, I bought two of these $5,000 units. I one for me and one for my parents. He goes, I have one of them right here. And I goes, I tested. He goes, when we remove the molecular hydrogen component from the Kangen, virtually no value, no benefit to people. It was the molecular hydrogen that's the reason why people were liking that unit. But I didn't want to have contaminants in my water to be able to make it. So now what I do is like I have this Brown's gas machine that makes oxygen, molecular hydrogen, and electrically expanded water, which is a whole nother benefit to my endothelial cells and my blood and my cardiovascular system at, more specifically. But I'm like, how do I get my water clean? So I was like, oh, I'll just run it through the triple purifier and then charge it with this and then drink it. And then I can also breathe the gas from this deal. And then I had this download come to me that I need to get into quantum water. And I didn't even know what that was. And 6 months later, this guy got to me. And right now I am in the middle of, I'm 8 months into the study of this. We have some of these units for sale that this guy makes. He's an inventor, but he had this extreme like family emergency he's got to take care of. I haven't interviewed him yet. On my podcast, we haven't even got all the documentation done, but we want to be able to show people how it works and give them different types of ways to test the water in their home. So it's not some ethereal thing that Tim said it works and trust me. Right. So what this water system now does is what I've been told, and I use it, and we've microgreens growers, the greens are growing. We've seen a whole pomegranate orchard in 2 years come back and bursting. It was dying and just the water, no fertilizer, bursting with pomegranates. And great things have happened. I love the taste of it. It's quantum water. So the water goes through the system and it takes all of the chemicals and breaks them back down into their elemental state. Because even chemicals, if they're from this planet, they originally came from nature, but they got messed around in a lab. Nature will eventually break them back down. It might take 100,000 years, like these PFAS or whatever. But eventually nature will handle them. Maybe not in our lifetime, but it will. This system has the ability to do that. And he's tested it with glyphosate and some other stuff, and it's worked well. But we haven't proven it yet, so I can't really tell you. I mean, I have them for sale right now. You might want to get one of the little handheld units. They're like $495. You could just do your own experiments until I get Joseph back, and I can finish the testing. But we've seen some amazing stuff. Even my rusty pipes from this farm that I bought for my parents, we put the thing on there, and 70% of that iron crappy taste was gone. But I said, Joseph, it still tastes like that. And he's like, well, you might need to put on a second or even a third unit because the pipes are so old. And then finally he was like, dude, wait a minute. Did you get the whole pipe from the well all the way in? And I was like, no, there's about 20, 30 foot from the well underground. It goes into our pump house. And then I put the unit on in there. And then it goes about 50 feet into the house and, you know, where I've been drinking it or so. He said, oh, well, what's happening is it's probably healed the pipe from where it started to the house. But it's still got that section behind it where all that oxidization is coming through and you're still getting that. It's almost the exact same percentage of pipe based on what I told him. There's like 30% of the pipes left. I was like, oh, holy crap. So he built me a 2-inch unit with a camera in it, and we have to yet to install it. We're going to install it and watch this and see if it heals the pipes. And if it heals the pipes, because he said it should theoretically just take the oxidization, reverse it, and the pipes will heal and become metal again and it will stop the oxidization. I was like, holy crap, if we can get this on tape, we got something. Because we can advertise heal your pipes, heal yourself, heal your body type thing. And we can actually save people's pipes. So some people, their pipes are too far gone. It might not work. But if it's rusty and bad, but the pipes are still pretty good quality, we could bolt the system on at their wellhead, heal their entire pipes, and save them $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $25,000 of digging up stuff and messing everything up, right? So we're very excited about the technology. It's way beyond anything that I've seen before. And I have a lot to learn about it. But as far as water goes right now in distillation, I'm kind of beyond distillation now. I'm looking at triple purification. but what I would say is that if I had my – if I was somewhere and there was like I'm on an airplane and I've got, you know, no water or I'd probably just do no water, just dry fast, but I would probably do smart water because that's, you know, distilled, but that's in plastic bottles. So I'd avoid that. I would try to find something in a glass bottle, probably spring water or distilled water. And just, it's the best of the worst. Right. So I don't really can't speak to any more on that, man, but it's been a constant, it's an ongoing saga on the water journey over here.
Well, thank you very much for that. When you come to your final determination, can you please share with me the results of your research? Or maybe even if you just want to tell me the best that you've got thus far. Yeah, I'm very interested in that topic.
So. Yeah, so what we believe, it's on our website under the chemicalfreebody.com, under the shop tab, under Tim's, well, it actually says Water Hero. And like I said, I totally feel comfortable sending people to, I mean, I have a bunch of doctors and stuff that have already bought the household units. They've already done it and they're loving it, but I just really haven't launched it to the public yet just because I want to make sure, because I have thousands of people following me. And if I say something, they're really trusting me to do the best I can. And I will not break that trust. It's very important to me. I can't do it anyway. It's not my nature. I have to do what's right for me. It's just like the Kongen units I've sold. I mean, I'm one of their, I kind of almost, I'm supposed to go on stage and speak at their event. I've never, I have a gal that does all the stuff for me. She's one of their distributors, but now I'm pivoting because I found something better and I learned something new. And so I have to change, you know, I can't keep going the old way when I know something new that's better for me and for my family and for the people that are following me. So, but you can go to my website at chemicalfreebody.com and register. And get a free ebook, get a $10 gift card, and a free 30-minute consult, and you know, and get in our email list. And eventually, when that comes out, I will be sending an email out. And then I also have a podcast called The Health Hero Show that's going to be changed to The Tim James Show pretty soon. And there'll be eventually an episode out on it when I interview Joseph. You'll see it. And but if you, in the meantime, like I said, man, if you want to get a handheld, they're like $495, and there has been zero returns so far for the people that know us. That have been getting him kind of undercover here.
Well, thank you, Tim. This has been great. You brought up a lot of new proper nouns I've never heard before. I'm going to have to read more about all those things and have some better questions to ask you on a follow-up.
You had some really good ones, dude. Some of the best we've had so far. No doubt about it.
Hey, and Richards, thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the Health and Wealth Podcast. And to be able to see all of our previous guests, like the phenomenal Paul Lim from, we're going to just go talk about the San Diego Financial Literacy Center. I don't know if they can find you there or not, but are you actually on the board there, or in what capacity can someone find you if they want to learn more about you and about the San Diego Financial Literacy Center?
Yes, sure. I am listed fairly well on the website and things of that nature. And if you'd like, I can even just put some of my contact information and you can maybe throw it in show notes if you'd like to afterwards. And yeah, I'm always willing to talk to anybody who's interested in the subject matter. And like I said, I do feel as though I am doing important work when we can bring advice and useful knowledge to people who want it, even if you can't immediately monetize it. It's just part of giving back when you have a professional license and are out here to serve others.
Awesome. Yeah, we will definitely have that in the show notes for you, in Richard, so you can find out more information about Paul Lim and how to be able to get in contact with him. And maybe you want to learn how you can be able to do it in your own community. Who knows? But for all of our other previous guests, as I was mentioning, you can go to our website at www.thehealthandwealthpodcastshow.com and make sure to like, share, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Podbean, Google Podcasts, wherever the case may be. So for my phenomenal co-host, Mr. Chemical Free Body himself, Tim James, I'm Carter Wilcox, and CEO and founder of CSI Financial Group, wishing you all a wonderful rest of your day. Paul, seriously, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing so much of your story and your amazing journey that you're doing out there.
Thank you. I really appreciate you guys inviting me on your show.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Paul.
Yes, thank you, Paul. And we will see you next time on the Health and Wealth Podcast. Thank you, everybody. Hey, Enrichers. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Health and Wealth Podcast. I'm your host, Carter Wilcoxon.
And I'm your host, Tim James. And by God, we are committed to helping you guys have fat wallets, flat bellies,
So tune in again for another episode and make sure to like, share, and drink a lot of water.
Or beer.
You have just listened to the Health and Wealth Podcast with Carter and Tim.